This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Once just a radio show, but podcast listeners like you are part of the fastest growing segment of our audience. So thanks for downloading what you might call the Pocket Takeaway. Here's our daily show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. In the 1980s, in the midst of the war on drugs, school districts started enlisting local police officers to patrol their hallways. And that trend only grew after the Columbine High School shooting in 1999. School officials claim that officers are there to ensure student safety. But what role should cops play in school discipline?
He grabbed me and tried to take me to the office. I started pushing him away. He slammed me down and then he handcuffed me.
That's Caleb Moon Robinson. Caleb is 11 years old. He's an African-American sixth grader from Lynchburg in Virginia. Caleb has autism, and his mom says that his diagnosis led to behavioral problems at school, which led to Caleb's arrest at Lincoln Middle School last November. Caleb isn't alone. Our next guest crunched the numbers, and it turns out that Virginia refers more students to police than any other state in the nation. Joining us is Susan Ferris, reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Susan, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
First, Virginia, such an outlier. It has a rate of these types of referrals by police of kids, young kids, some as young as 4 years old, to the courts that is three times the national average. What's going on in Virginia?
What we found is when we drilled down in Virginia, we found that the state isn't really keeping track of what these referrals are for. The national data doesn't say. There are numbers of referrals, and they could be arrests. They could be tickets or summons to court. A referral doesn't have to end in an arrest or charges. But what we found in the districts that we looked at more closely is that there are a lot of arrests and charges that end up getting filed in juvenile court. These are for kids who are in middle school often. Some of the numbers were quite startling. In one district, we found that kids who were under 10 were accused of assault and were written up and sent to court. Five children under 10 in one district, Chesterfield, were accused of making bomb threats. And you have the case of Caleb Moon Robinson in Lynchburg, who was accused of disorderly conduct and felony assault on a police officer because he had walked out of class without permission. The school police officer assigned to his school was sent to get him, and he tried to direct him, apparently, into the office and grabbed him. And Caleb struggled with him and used some bad language, and then he ended up arrested.
You talked to Stacy Doss, who's Caleb's mom.
And I'm like, well, why is it a felony? And he stated to me it was because he was an officer. And because Caleb fought an officer, that escalated the charges. And I thought, Caleb is 11. He is autistic. He doesn't fully understand how to differentiate the roles of certain people.
Susan, that's Caleb's mom. Another mom in your story was told directly by a police officer, I do arrest fifth graders.
That's right. That was in Henrico County near Richmond. A fifth grader named Elijah Coles Brown was reprimanded by a school police officer who lectured him and asked him if he knew what the meaning of assault was. And this was after, I hesitate to call it an incident, but it was what the school considered horseplay in the cafeteria. Apparently, the other boy's family contacted the police, and Elijah's mother felt that he interrogated him.
One of the things that you found, though, Susan Ferris, is that many of these problems the schools would prefer to be handling, like the kind of school discipline that I think a lot of us remember from our own school days or expect for our own children, but that cops in these schools operate independently. The principals and vice principals don't feel as though they have any sway over what the police are doing at all.
This isn't something people want to talk about very freely. The districts that I contacted mostly sent statements about this, what their policies were. But I was surprised when a number of them said, the police don't work for us. They work for the police department. And the police are the ones who decide if They're going to file a criminal complaint if a crime has been committed. And some of them suggested that there is some discussion at times, but I got the feeling that they do believe that the police are the ones who are the ones who make the decisions ultimately.
Now, one police officer did speak with you. He's Don Bridges. He's with the National Association of School Resource Officers, and he does some training.
As long as there's nothing where there's a weapon, something that's going to cause immediate public harm, charging of a student within the school setting should be the absolute last resort.
Last resort is what he told you, Susan Ferris. But going back to Chesterfield County, in your story, 3,538 complaints that police filed over 3 years, a staggering number, many of them for disorderly conduct.
That's right. Simple assault or disorderly conduct. And more than half of the students sent to court were Black, even though Black students are only 26% of enrollment. And more than half were children 14 or younger.
The Department of Education in Washington has a civil rights division, and you spoke with the leader of that division.
Black boys in particular are suspended and expelled from schools at rates that are, most recent data is about three times the rate of their white peers. Black girls are more likely to be suspended and expelled from school than most boys and any other girls. And students with disabilities are subject to discipline at rates that well exceed their peers without disabilities.
That's Catherine Lehman. She's Assistant U.S. Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. She spoke with you, Susan Ferris. Do you have confidence that the federal government, for its part, which has a minor role probably related to state governments when it comes to education policy, see a real problem here?
Well, you're right in that states have their own policies. And in fact, school districts are often autonomous in how they conduct discipline policies, although there are state laws and there are federal laws, especially civil rights laws. They're concerned about it. What they do is usually approach a district based on a complaint that a parent may have filed or looking at their own data that they've collected and deciding that there are some suspiciously disproportionate numbers. And they approach a district and try to work with the district and reach an agreement. In fact, in Caleb Moon Robinson's district last August, an agreement was reached with the Civil Rights Office of the Department of Education to reduce the suspensions of Black students.
Susan Ferris is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Her story about school discipline premieres this week on Reveal, a public radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Public Radio Exchange. Susan Ferris, thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. How do you think schools should be disciplining our kids? From Massachusetts, respectfully, our school resource officer is part of the school, lives in the community, attends events, and interacts with students. Respect breeds respect. And this from New Jersey, you cannot discipline kids in public schools anymore. Parents won't allow it. There's no support for the classroom teacher. Principals and superintendents just want to keep their job. So if a kid gets in trouble, there are no actions taken. If the schools do try to correct a situation, parents throw around the dreaded sue word. Kids know that now, and they have the upper hand, and they use it.
This is Ray from Arlington. I think that children should be taught how to resolve disputes in school. Having an officer on site is good for security, but they should not be part of the disciplinary practice at all.
Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE to share your thoughts on discipline in schools or tweet us at The Takeaway. Back in the early 90s, the Centers for Disease Control was funding plenty of research into gun safety. The studies found that people in homes with guns had a higher likelihood of violent death in the home than people in homes without guns. The NRA did not like that research, and they lobbied supportive members of Congress who turned around and banned the CDC from funding research that might, quote, advocate or promote gun control. And that story is the subject of the final installment in our series this week, Political Science, Where Evidence and Ideology Collide. And our guest is Dr. Fred Rivara. He's a professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the University of Washington at Seattle's Children's Hospital. Rivara is the guy, along with Dr. Arthur Kellerman, who found the conclusion that today has become almost a cliche in the debate. If you have a gun in the home, you're actually less safe on average than if you don't. And that means Dr. Rivara saw firsthand the chilling effects that came from that congressional crackdown on gun research and how it still intimidates scientists today.
We did a series of studies back in the late 80s and early 90s. What we did is we looked at homes where there was a homicide that occurred, and then also went to homes in the neighborhood around the block where there was no homicide. We sent out experienced interviewers and asked them a series of questions, including whether or not there was a gun in the home. And we found out that having the gun in the home was associated with a significant increase, about a threefold increase in the risk of homicide occurring in the home from any means. You know, the most common reason that people have a gun is because they have it for home protection. They feel like it is important to protect themselves and their family from harm. Unfortunately, the data indicate that having a gun in the home is associated with both an increased risk of homicide, but even more importantly, an increased risk of suicide. We know that, for example, if there's a gun in the home, that the risk of suicide among adolescents and young adults is increased tenfold.
Now, can you walk me through the experience a little bit? Back in 1993, when Dr. Kellerman and you were on that team, released this article, series of articles, largely in the New England Journal of Medicine, the National Rifle Association reacted. Can you walk me through the experience, what happened with the NRA and what happened with your research?
Well, I think it's important for you to, again, emphasize that this work was all published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is then and still is one of the most respected journals in the world. So it really underwent peer review. It was felt to be very solid and worthwhile research. The CDC stood by our research. They had funded the research, and they stood by it. Unfortunately, it raised the attention of the National Rifle Association, who then worked with pro-gun members of Congress to essentially stop funding of firearm research. What happened was the 10 senators in Congress at that time approached Senator Arlen Specter, who was the chair of the Health and Human Services Subcommittee, and he approached the director of the Centers for Disease Control and discussed the idea that this research was biased and that they ended up cutting the CDC budget by the exact amount of money that was used to fund the gun research. They at first threatened to cut all of the funding for injury research at the CDC. They didn't do that, but they ended up cutting it by the exact amount that was spent on the gun research. More importantly, however, was that they put in a clause for the appropriations of the CDC that essentially blocked all gun research for the next two decades.
As you've said, Dr. Rivara, there was no congressional ban on this type of research. But Dr. Kellerman wrote in 2012, he said, no federal employee was willing to risk his or her career or the agency's funding to find out what the boundaries of these rules were. Extramural support for firearm injury prevention research quickly dried up. What was your experience of that?
It has been true. And as a result of that, many, many people stopped doing gun research. The number of publications on firearm violence decreased dramatically. Personally, it was really a frightening time. I can remember back in those days, 20 years ago, when we were really frightened about what was going to happen to our injury research program, what was going to happen to us personally, because it did feel as a personal attack. What's more is that the NRA in 1991, when some of our first research came out, wrote the National Institute of Health to get an Office of Scientific Integrity review of our research. Now, that's a big deal. There's only two or three of these that are done each year, and basically it's questioning our credentials as a scientist, saying that we had lied or falsified our research. Fortunately, the NIH did not find any basis for that, and the CDC backed us up. But it was really chilling in terms of our ability to conduct research on this very important problem.
Can we talk a little bit about your personal experience, maybe your emotional reaction as somebody who was devoting a good portion of their professional life to this type of research? It was peer-reviewed. It was published in probably one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world. And yet politics, political groups got a hold of it and said, nope, not true, and they vilified you. How did it feel to have your science digested and spat out by the political world?
Well, I think it was in one way frightening in that people would criticize you so vehemently about your work. On the other hand, it was also good because it told us that we were doing important work.
Dr. Fred Rivara, professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the University of Washington at Seattle's Children's Hospital. He's been involved with injury research for 30 years. You can hear our entire series, Political Science, Where Evidence and Ideology Collide, at thetakeaway.org. This hour, we're talking about discipline in schools. How do you think school administrators should discipline your kids?
Hi, this is Karen from New Jersey. Community service is a great way to discipline kids in school. It's more constructive than suspension, and it allows the student to give back to the community and hopefully learn some important lessons in the process, such as making a positive difference in the lives of others. And it also prevents them from falling further behind in their studies.
From Tampa, Florida, for all that is holy, put the discipline of the kids back in the parents' hands. A spanking and a stern and direct conversation with your kid never killed anybody. A listener in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina writes, "School is preparation for real life. Police are real life. They should have mock programs that simulate the real world when it comes to discipline." Join this conversation. Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, break down, baby.
No time to browse the web this week? Well, you know nothing. But Sham Ramesfaran, host of the podcast Sideshow, hangs five for us every week with the Friday Five. Five online things you have to check out this week. And this week, winter is coming. We're all in on Game of Thrones. Season 5 premieres on Sunday. Sean, welcome.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
What's the best GOT-related web stuff this week?
Well, last week, it was like a lot of fan stuff, but this week, the Game of Thrones tribute and recaps reached this critical mass where other TV shows were posting stuff online. The first thing I think everyone got a glimpse of was Jon Snow at a dinner party with Seth Meyers and his pals for his show. And if we know anything about Jon Snow, one of the main characters in Game of Thrones, it is that
he knows nothing.
He knows nothing, and he also knows nothing about dinner etiquette.
Thank you all so much for coming over.
Of course, this is so nice.
You know, I actually walked here all the way from Brooklyn because it's so beautiful today.
New York is gorgeous in the spring.
Spring is officially sprung.
Winter is coming.
He proceeds to talk a lot about, you know, the fact that he's a bastard, as they say in the show, and that his first love died, and that he doesn't know who his mother is. It's really depressing stuff. And
not great dinner company.
It just makes it really uncomfortable for Seth and his pals.
Number two,
the Washington Post used to be a troubled publication, and then that guy from the Amazon bought it, I read. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah, something like that. And now they have the money to do the Illustrated Guide to All 426 Deaths in All Four Seasons of Game of Thrones. They did this huge presentation of all the deaths with like charts and little characters and little icons. It was really impressive and thorough.
Number three,
Key and Peele from Comedy Central did their own recap of deaths from Game of Thrones. It wasn't as thorough as the Washington Post's, but it was probably a lot cheaper and a lot funnier for sure.
But you know who my favorite character is?
Who's that dog?
Khaleesi's.
Khaleesi.
No, I'll be liking some Khaleesi's dog. But what about Khaleesi's straight up with them dragons?
Khaleesi's with them dragons. And Khaleesi's all like this. And then we talking about.
Just straight roasting goats! Yo!
Oh my God.
That's the old Liam Neeson's bit.
There's two valets in LA who are really into Liam Neeson's. Yeah. Liam Neeson's, of course, does not yet appear in Game of Thrones, but Khaleesi's does, and also Peter Dinklage, who they refer to as Da Dinkles.
Number four.
You know, it's not just late night TV getting in on the Game of Thrones action this week. Sesame Street also took a swipe at season 5. Before we play the clip, I think we should set up the fact that instead of playing the sort of figurative Game of Thrones, they play the literal Game of Thrones, which is a game of musical chairs.
Gesteros needs a new king or queen. And to decide, we will play a game. A game of chairs!
Huzzah!
And here to tell you how to play the game is Grover Bluejoy. Grover Bluejoy? Where is Grover Bluejoy?
Sorry, I'm late! But it was really hard getting over that wall out there. Whoa! Oh, sorry.
It's so much more pleasant than the actual show.
I want to be a kid again so I could enjoy that as a child. Let's hope that isn't like a gateway drug to the actual show because those kids are going to be traumatized.
We don't need kids watching Game of Thrones. Kids, if you're listening, earmuffs. Number five.
Number five. For those of us who aren't yet caught up, I mean, what are you doing with your life? But also, Jimmy Fallon and The Roots were nice enough to do a rap recap or a re-rap of the show.
King Joffy was dead and gone. Soon after saying them wet vows. Apparently it's poison. Involved. Everybody blamed it on Tarion. Brand had a premonition now, and he's off to find what he's dreamt about.
So if you're not down with the GOT and you don't know what Sean and I are talking about, you can go to that recap, get all caught up.
That's right.
Binge four seasons, get up on Game of Thrones because season five starts Sunday. Sean Ramaswaran is host of the podcast Sideshow, produced by our friends at Studio 360. Sean, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And you can catch the best five Game of Thrones things online on our website at thetakeaway.org. It's Movie Friday here on The Takeaway when we talk about what's hitting the big screen this weekend with Movie Date co-hosts Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer. Of course, in addition to hosting the Movie Date podcast, Rafer is film critic for Newsday. Kristen is our own culture producer here at The Takeaway. Hi, guys. Thanks for being here.
Happy Friday,
hey, Todd.
Great to see you. Let's get right to it with our first movie of the week. Now, this is a romance movie based on a Nicholas Sparks novel. Focuses on two couples, one in modern times, one in a World War II kind of flashback, called The Longest Ride.
Hey, Ruth, I need to ask you something.
Wait. I want a big family, a really big family. Everything that's going on now, I feel this need, this responsibility to bring life back into the world.
Sounds perfect.
You can ask me now.
Rafer, is it perfect?
It's not perfect. It's just a John Sparks. Nicholas Sparks adaptation. I think this one's made with a little more care and attention to detail. You've got Una Chaplin there, granddaughter of Charlie Chaplin. You've got Scott Eastwood, son of Clint Eastwood. The acting is pretty good, but I think ultimately you're still getting a Nicholas Sparks adaptation, which is very gooey and very schmaltzy.
Kristen Meinzer, I'm getting the feeling this is your kind of film.
I usually love a good tear-jerking romance, but this was not gooey enough. And I hate to say it, but I did not cry once during this movie.
Oh, no.
I love to cry. I want to see the full explosion of romance. I want to see love lost, love won. And I just felt that this ran way too long. And while it looked pretty good, as Rafer's saying, it just didn't pack the emotional punch. And yeah,
gooey, but not quite gooey enough for Kristen. Let's move on to our second movie from Noah Baumbach. This one stars Ben Stiller, Naomi Watts, Adam Driver, Amanda Seyfried. It's about a 40-something couple that makes friends with a couple of 20-somethings. It's called While We're Young.
We met this interesting couple, Jamie and Darby. He's a young documentarian, and she makes ice cream.
I don't know what to make of them, honestly. I like her.
They make everything. It's infectious. For about 12 hours, I thought I could build my own desk.
Kristen Meinzer, this is 40, the story of a 40-year-old couple now interacting with some younger people.
Yeah, and I feel that this movie's probably targeting me as a New Yorker who doesn't have kids, who's the same age as this couple. But I feel that they didn't quite get it right because the younger couple, rather than seeming 15 years younger than them, seems 50 years younger than them. And everyone's wildly self-unaware and mostly irritating. I, in the end, didn't love this movie.
Rafer.
I mean, this hits me pretty much exactly where it counts. I pretty much am Ben Stiller, except I don't have his career. But it did. I agree with Kristen. It didn't quite hit me on an emotional level, more on an intellectual level. But I did enjoy it quite a bit. And Adam Driver and Ben Stiller as these kind of multi-generational doppelgangers are actually really fun.
Yeah, and it's easy to see how they could pull that off in a spectacular way. Well, let's talk about a third movie. This is Ex Machina. This is exciting. It stars Oscar Isaac as a brilliant and reclusive robot inventor and Domhnall Gleeson as a naive programmer brought in to test Isaac's latest invention.
Do you know what the Turing test is?
It's when a human interacts with a computer. And if the human doesn't know they're interacting with a computer, the test is passed.
And what does the pass tell us?
That the computer has artificial intelligence. Are you building an AI?
I've already built one.
Now, rather than have Rafer and Kristen review Ex Machina, we have something special. Kristen, you sat down with Oscar Isaac this week to talk about Ex Machina as well as artificial intelligence more broadly.
Yeah, and I have to first of all say Oscar Isaac was incredible. He was smart. He was a lot of fun. And one of the first things we really got into was the whole idea of this robot Ava he invents being so sexy.
You have to remember this is the character Nathan. You know, he is a dark figure. He is okay ushering in the end of civilization. And again, he's up there by himself. And this speaks to his sexual proclivities. And there's a phenomenon that happens when this machine becomes self-aware. It wants to escape. That's the first thing that happens. So I think he believes that the better he makes the model, the better it'll be at trying to escape. And one of these days, when he makes it so good, so intelligent, it will escape.
Is that the goal, do you think? Or do you think the goal is that he wants to make the ultimate robot who will never want to escape?
I think he knows that it's a matter of time. I mean, he says that one of these days, don't feel bad for the AIs. They're going to look back on us like primitive animals with crude language and tools. So he knows that that's coming. I think to get back to the sexuality thing, for him, and this is an argument in the film, he says he makes the argument that you cannot have consciousness without sexuality, because at the root of consciousness is interaction, and sexuality is quite an interaction. So he makes them sexual by design, and who's going to interact with them sexually? He's the only guy up there. He's the only person there. So he has sex with these robots in order to enlighten them. Or so he believes.
So he believes.
Yes, but they're actually trapped. They're trapped there. And it does bring up the idea, if we get to the point where we can make a machine that seems to be self-aware, what rights does it then have?
But then won't they all just take over, just like the movie speculates? And just as movies have speculated for decades and decades, the fear of the robot takeover.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, there are some very serious scientific thinkers that believe that we have to caution with that. You know, we have to have caution when we do that. But there's also optimists that believe as our machines become more powerful, we also will become more machine with nanotechnology, with, you know, who knows, downloading our brains into certain, software. And history has shown us that we don't really have control over the things we make. And that's something that we've been grappling with as humans for a long time. I mean, that's why the Frankenstein tale, you know, all these tales, you know, we see that with industry, with the system, economic system, social systems that we create. You know, we kind of give over to them and then we become, to a certain extent, enslaved by them.
That's Oscar Isaac, Golden Globe-nominated star of Inside Llewyn Davis, A Most Violent Year, and the upcoming Star Wars films. His newest film in limited release today is called Ex Machina. Now, Kristen, you can hear the rest of your interview with Oscar Isaac on next week's podcast. Please tell me that there's at least one Star Wars clue in the interview.
There sure is. And by Star Wars clue, I mean not really. I did ask him about Star Wars. And so we're airing that next week, the full interview, rather than this week. And that's because this week we have our Kristen Stewart interview where she's talking about the clouds of Sils Maria. And we were thrilled to talk with her. So listen to that on this week's podcast.
You sat down with Kristen Stewart for this week. Oscar Isaac will be next week with no Star Wars clues, unfortunately. But I'm still going to listen anyway because it's a fascinating interview. It would have been that much better with Star Wars because we're all waiting for him in that. But Oscar Isaac is phenomenal in that. Kristen Meinzer sat down with both of them. Kristen Meinzer is our Movie Date co-host and culture producer here at The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman, the other co-host and film critic at Newsday. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
So for all of our talk about ballpark figures this week, we've resisted the urge to share too many baseball statistics. But thanks to the folks at Business Insider Magazine, here's something to take with you the next time you head off for the game, a guide to what a small beer is going to cost you at the ballpark. We'll start with the good news. The Arizona Diamondbacks, the Cleveland Indians, a measly $4. The good news, too, if you're a little thirsty and find yourself at the Angels or the Rangers in Texas, the Padres, the A's, the Tigers, or the Cardinals of St. Louis, or under some Florida sunshine at the Rays, a beer here is $5. But it starts to look a little nasty in San Francisco. Sure, the setting is great, but a small beer there is going to cost you $7. And the Braves, sure, they have a great organist, but a beer is going to set you back even more, $7.25. The second most expensive place in the country, Minnesota. A beer at the Twins, $7.50. But be warned, the top three ballparks where your wallet's going to get thinner when you drink: Fenway Park, Wrigley Field, Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia. The average price of a small beer, $7.75. As a reminder, if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. Unlike beer at big league ballparks, it's free. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. And our Weekender podcast this weekend will showcase all of our ballpark figure stories from our series this week. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service that you use to get your podcast fix. You can also ask me anything on Twitter about ballpark figures, beer prices, the Washington Nationals, or politics in Washington, D.C. Send me your comments or questions. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.